Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Welcome to another episode of Pemba On Demand today. I'm very excited that you could join us today. We have a great show for you. Dr. Kirk Pinto is joining us. Kirk is a 2018 alumnus from the University of Tennessee Pemba program, pediatric urologist, and right now, as you'll learn during this episode, during this live stream, is really focused on physician wellness with Cook Children's Physician Network in Texas, practices still as a pediatric urologist. And Kirk, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I'm excited to do this.
It's great to have you here. It's always fun to meet different Pemba alumni and to find out what they're doing and what they're interested and passionate about. I'm looking forward to hearing your educational session for us today. We're going to be talking about burnout in corporate medicine, the pitfalls and opportunities. That's the title of our show today. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your background and what really led to your interest and your focus on physician burnout.
I have worked at Cook Hospital for nearly 30 years. I worked for Cook Hospital for about 5 years. An example of sort of the bad part of corporate medicine is always Cook was biting around my practice trying to buy it. And we continued to sort of refuse and refuse till they came to a point where they hired our competition for us and made it so that we had no, it's a whole other story. I had a urology practice that was on, that we put on the NASDAQ. It was a publicly traded urology practice, which is a bad idea if you want to talk about financial bad ideas, because you spend all your time trying to fill out forms. Anyway, we eventually were able to sell that in an all stock deal, and then I could jump to Cook. And what I did, the bosses that they had potentially, that they had actually hired for me, burned me out in a minute. I went from a job that I loved for 24 years to a job that I hated every single day. So I was at an AUA meeting, American Urological Association meeting. I saw someone I trained in Memphis, my pediatric urology. I saw someone I knew standing at a Pemba table. I had no idea what a Pemba table was. I asked him what he was doing here. I am sorry, I don't remember who the person was behind the table, but he said, "Oh, I'm talking to my friend from Haslam School of Medicine." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he told me about this physician MBA. And I was so sort of, I need to do something else. I signed up that day. I'd never thought of it before. I never talked to my wife about it before. I signed up that day. And that's how I got to be in the Pemba program. Then I needed a project. My project was with Dick Reisenstein, who's retired a couple of years back. I think my project drove him out of academia. But the project was, I talked to the then president of the network. He said that he had noted that as they grew the network, the physicians were not as enthusiastic. They were not as happy with the job. Unbeknownst to them, burnout was occurring. So on a marketing strategy, I did whatever Reisenstein told me to do and found burnout. And then I reported it not knowing it was burnout. I told the CEO of the practice of the entire organization, 10,000 people, here's what I found. He politely pushed it back to me and said, "I think our doctors are pretty happy." They eventually tested for burnout because the board at Cook Hospital is all these cattle barons and oil energy people. And they said, "Now we get this problem in our organization. What about you?" And turns out Dr. Reisenstein and I were entirely right. And so they called me back. They said, "Hey, we want you to take care of this." And that's how I sort of backed in, like most things in my life, how I backed into burnout. And I've been doing that for about half time for about 3 years.
Great. Well, let's have you share your presentation with us, and then we'll come back and I'll have some follow-up questions, and maybe we'll have some questions from the audience as well.
Sure. I do a fair number of these talks at different hospitals and venues like this. And so there are some things that sort of that people sort of pull out of me, like dentists pulling teeth, to sort of find some stuff out. So if we could level set first and sort of tell you what it is I want to talk about, and specifically what I want to talk about, as Norm mentioned, is burnout in corporate medicine. So we can go to the next slide. I think the audience here is aware because we're all trained as MBAs, we're aware of what businesses want to do. When nobody goes to a business meeting or a five-year planning meeting and says, we want to be smaller next year, we want to make fewer profits next year. You know, the goal of change for MBAs and for people in business is always to get bigger and bigger. And so in medicine, as medicine has become more corporate, burnout, you know, if you think about it, is actually a pretty predictable result. When a business buys anything, they spend money on and expect improvements and expect a bigger return on investment. And the way we measure that, as we learned in our PEMBA classes, is by doing various metrics. And so the metrics that a business person would obviously sort of apply over the practices they bought and the hospitals that they bought is to look at production to see sort of how many patients go through the facility. And that would be something they would obviously want to ramp up. People don't think of best practices as a business sort of decision. But if you think about it, it is, because everything about business is budgets. And so if you land on a best practice, this is the way we treat diabetics. And you know, at a business meeting that we're going to have, we average 100 new diabetics a month. Best practices allows them to say, okay, we have 100 new patients. We're going to do exactly this, nothing else. We're not going to have some rogue doctor practicing the art of medicine. We're going to do exactly this. And we know exactly what our budget is. They have instituted more aggressively an RVU compensation model. How that's a good business practice is it can be a carrot and a stick. For in our institution previously, our RVU model was, I'll make these numbers up, but I had to do 5,000 RVUs a month. I'm sorry, a year. And if I did 5,000 RVUs in a year, they would pay me $50 an RVU. But if I did 5,001, they would pay me $70 for that RVU and $70 for each following RVU. So that is a big carrot. And it's a way for the business to sort of get away with kind of pushing you to work harder just by having you chase the money. They can really take a hands-off approach. We're not making you do that. You only have to do the first 5,000. But the result of that sort of payment scheme is that they get a lot more work out of people without forcing them to do it. Those of you that are old enough know that ancillaries used to be a way for people that were procedure-based to sort of do outpatient procedures at a place that they controlled. So in my life, I've owned a couple of surgery centers. The average return to me of the profits, the doctors used to take home around 70% of the money that we got out of 70% of the profit that we got out of ancillaries. We did have partners, we had managing companies, and sometimes we had insurance companies in there to make up the other 30% of the ownership. Hospitals, we were just talking about this offline. Hospitals have bought up a lot of those ancillaries, a lot of surgery centers, a lot of freestanding ERs. And so now in the surgery center I own now, the doctors only take home around 30%, get a 30% share of the profit. And so that's become very profitable for corporations. And then everybody's favorite is satisfaction surveys. That a way to measure sort of how your employees are doing is to look at how your customers view them. And I think it's understandable how doctors feel about satisfaction surveys. But just purely looking at this as though it were without any adding any value to it, these are all reasonable practices if you ran a business to sort of maximize your result. And then what you would do at the end is you'd find where you're getting stuck. You don't have enough production. The ancillaries are not performing like they should. And you attack the rate limiting step. In practice, people, physicians sort of have a different idea of what change should look like. Those of you that have had a term paper due in two weeks are aware of this curve. There's this, you go from calm, I don't have to sort of do this 14 days away, to it's due tomorrow, and you go to distress at the other end. But the best place psychologists would tell us to work is in a place called eustress, where there's your performance is good, but you have some mild level of stress. And for doctors, you sort of try to get to a place where you're not sort of running around like a nut all the time, but where you're pressured enough to make sure you're doing your work. So if you take these same measurements and look at them from a doctor's standpoint, obviously you were toiling in a system and were trying as good employees to produce return on investment. But I do not have to tell you that increases in your production, more patients, more days work is not a healthy practice for most doctors. Best practices are like a ball and chain, right? That you have to do what someone else has decided. And the idea that you would, that every diabetic is exactly the same, every hypertension is exactly the same, is an anathema to physicians, that we're not allowed much agency in how we practice. The RVU compensation model, I already told you how that is a sort of concealed carrot that is very effective in getting us to work sort of harder than we want. the loss in ancillaries I've described before. And satisfaction surveys are, again, anathema to physicians. In this institution, since I've taken this job, we had dueling satisfaction surveys from the emergency department. The emergency department asked the patients when they were there, did the doctor adequately control your pain? And this was in the middle of sort of the turnaround on giving narcotics and things like that. So often the patients did not feel as though their pain was adequately controlled. And because of that, how compassionate was the doctor? The doctor was not compassionate. He didn't give me the pain medicine that I asked for. And that part of the survey was tied to their compensation. So the hospital at the same time in the same survey said, you got to use less medicine. We're going to base your pay on that. And at the same time said, you got to satisfy these patients who are in pain, and we're going to base your pay on that. And so there were dueling surveys within the same questions, and the ER doctors were literally damned if they did and damned if they didn't. And so when you look at all these things from a doctor standpoint, the rate limiting step, the thing that the administrators come to sort of chide you about is your care. Some people take longer to take care of. Some people need more medicine. Some people need less medicine. Some people don't fit the mold of best practices. And those things, if we try to be good doctors, it gets us in trouble and can lead to burnout. And so the question is, you know, everyone always says, and I think the verdict's still out on this, if you look at all the burnout surveys, if you do a literature search, most of the things that have physician and burnout in them, and when I say most, like 80% are written in the last 8 to 10 years. And the reason being is that as medicine has become more corporate, problems that corporations had have become our problems as well. And so when you sit down at a table with administrators, the big question is, are they doing this on purpose? Are they just sort of whipping us and making us work harder than we should and harder than we want to? Or do they just not understand what medicine's about? In my interaction with people in my organization and in other people talking around the country, I agree with this Hanlon's razor that I think that the administrators would want to have happy employees, would want to have happy doctors, would want to have happy patients, and they would do some compromise of those two positions I just showed you if they knew what it is exactly we do. And it is rare that any administrator absent an MD, MBA knows both sides of this coin. And so I think this is where the opportunity is. And that's the last slide. Thanks.
Thanks, Kirk. That was a great presentation. And it as I had suspected, it led to a couple of questions. You talk about burnout and sort of how burnout is occurring in corporate medicine. But there's a lot of questions that I get from physicians in terms of, or administrators. What exactly do you define burnout as? How do you identify it for people who are not familiar with the term?
Well, like anything else in medicine, I think there are accepted terms as to what burnout is. The first person to really characterize burnout was way back in the 1970s. Someone named Christina Maslach, who's still alive, and many of you may have taken the Maslach burnout survey. But she characterized burnout way back in the 70s as having three big components. And so when you look at the World Health Organization, they include these three components in their idea about burnout. And the three components are, one, emotional exhaustion. So all of us are working very hard and we go home tired. But people who are burned out come back tired. There's no recovery from, they don't go home and forget about the job and forget about work and come back fresh. I never understand how I see people every day sort of skipping into work, so happy to be there. They're not emotionally exhausted. Many of us are. And so emotional exhaustion is one component and the biggest component. The second component that Dr. Maslach talked about was depersonalization, the cynicism. You know, ideally, we think of every time we're standing outside the exam room door, we can't wait to blast that door open and see this new opportunity for challenge and things like that. And that's in an ideal environment. For many of us, especially burned out people, these people are landmines. There's going to be something wrong in here. They're going to be mad at me. I'm going to get a bad, review. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm not going to order enough labs. And so people that have that mindset, this cynical mindset, are said to be suffering from depersonalization. And that's a component of burnout. And then the third component of burnout is decreased personal accomplishment. So we didn't go into medicine only for the praise and only to be lauded all the time. But it's nice to have a little bit of that. And if you think that your job is inefficient and you're not competent and people don't view you as competent, if you get that feeling, those three things together, any one of those three components is terrible. But those three things together are what we define as burnout, and how you get there is through testing. So MassLack has a very expensive and very long survey that can help your organization sort of see that. You can take the AMA has surveys online that can help you with that. And really, it's been validated that if you just ask someone, are you burned out? They can answer the answer correctly. That correlates with all those other things. So you know it. It's like that old thing. I don't know this, but I know it when I see it. You know burnout when you see it. When you see people that are just hollowed out and sort of just spending their whole day trying to climb out of a hole. And you can come in and out of that. And we see that all the time. But it is devastating to see that your career choice becomes your undoing.
So what you had mentioned at the beginning, that when you matriculated into the MBA program, you felt you were at a point of burnout in your career. How did you overcome that? What did your journey back to enjoying what you're doing look like?
Yeah, first of all, I'm not a paid endorser, but PEMBA, right? That I had, I always liked going to school. I got into pediatric urology because if you do the math, it's the longest I could possibly train because I did not want to work. And I did work and I worked very hard and I did fine, but I did not like the job that I was sort of in. And so how PEMBA helped me was it gave me another avenue. It gave me another place to sort of focus my energies. It's known in the burnout literature that if just 20% of your time per week, per day, 20% of your time is spent on something you enjoy, the rate of burnout drops near to zero. And so you just need a little piece of your work to be enjoyable to you, a little piece of your work to be something you look forward to, and that can help you in that. And that's exactly what happened. I now had something else that I was enjoying, something new, that something was challenging. And that 20% doesn't have to be outside of medicine. We have pediatric offices where everybody was miserable, and we found one person liked to teach new mothers how to breastfeed. One person liked to counsel dads on how to discipline their sons and daughters. And so we carved up, you know, we put a little questionnaire in the when people called for new appointments and saw sort of where they were and funneled those patients to the right doctor. And that was very helpful for them to sort of have that skip in their step when they came to work because they were doing stuff they wanted to do. So it doesn't have to be a whole different school. It can just be, I can't imagine anyone likes this, but it just can be, I love to take care of back pain. And I hope I get a lot of back pain patients and we can accommodate that.
That's interesting. So that gives me a little bit of a window into my next question, which is, you know, what are some of the effective strategies that you've been allowed to put in place in your organization? You've talked about the tension between return on investment, physician workload, and those kinds of things. And I'm sure the organization wouldn't have adopted certain solutions if they had negatively impacted physician workflow to a great degree. But what are some of the things that you have been able to successfully implement?
System-wide, what we've been able to do is sort of change those employment contracts. So that we've mm-hmm. flipped it over. You get paid more for the first 5,000 RVUs, and you get paid less for those beyond. So we've stopped people running at full speed. We also have changed the newer, I don't know how many people here are interviewing newer doctors, but lifestyle is important to them. I mean, and mm-hmm. I have not been involved in the hiring process my whole career. But I now interview those people because they frankly want to know that there's somebody looking out for their wellness. And so we've switched to salaries on the newer people, and we only pay them 48 weeks. We're only paying you for 48 weeks. If you want to work those other 4 weeks, have at it. We're not giving you any money for it. We want to force you to take vacation. And people have, you know, those, they appreciate those ideas, and we've sort of systemically built stuff in to try to stop, you know, that sort of overwork. We're in the process now of sort of reworking our call schedule. This is a very collegial place, and in a place that worked on RVUs, it was almost encouraged that if I had to call a infectious disease doctor, I wouldn't necessarily call the person on call. I would call my favorite infectious disease doctor on the phone. And that was, they didn't mind that because they got more RVUs, but it led to the entire place having emotional exhaustion. You were never off work. I got called name a vacation, I got called on it to ask me about some goofy problem that should have been dealt with. So we're restructuring sort of the culture around things like that, so that only the call person is getting called. Everybody else has time off from work. And so there's numerous things like that that are, you know, on their face. If I just showed them to you, you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. It should be changed. The administration, whether they're doing it out of altruism or because they understand that more of us are quitting, more of us are quiet quitting, not working as hard, taking more days off, things like that than there were before, they realize that and they're willing so far to give me enough rope to sort of get those changes done.
Great. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So there's a question about measuring burnout, physician burnout. You talked about the Maslach inventory, and you talked about when you initially started this that they had measured for burnout in your organization. Is how did they measure it, and what are options besides the Maslach inventory, or maybe there is no better option than that?
Yeah. The good news about Maslach, if you don't have someone like a position like ours where already there's somebody in charge of burnout, Maslach brings an entire package. And what I mean by that is they will administer the test. They will give you the results. They'll tell you what the results mean. They'll contextualize them for you. They'll show you, you know, sort of strategies you could use to sort of make that better. And lo and behold, they have a service that'll come in as a consultant and sort of help you do that as well. So if your administration has no sort of idea starting fresh, the number one test, it's the most used test, it is the gold standard test, but it does come with a lot of add-ons that may or may not be too expensive for your program. The AMA has a program where they're just as helpful in terms of the testing. They call it an organizational biopsy, and they do something called the Mini Z. It's a 11 question test. You can add lots of other questions if you have ideas, but they administer the whole thing. You provide them with email addresses. They tell you how to advertise it. They send emails to all the physicians you want to get the test. They take the test, they score it, they give you your results back. In exchange, they get your data, right? That's the sort of the trade-off. They're not as good about actively sort of managing burnout for you. But if you look at their website, they have a lot of resources that if my organization got this score, here's what we can sort of try to do about that. There's something called the Copenhagen that you can, it's free use. You can use it in your organization. It's a lot of work because you have to score it yourself and then figure out what that means. And so those are the three biggest tests. Press Ganey and a lot of other people tell you they can measure the burnout. So Press Ganey wants to sell a comprehensive suite that looks at, say, your patient satisfaction, how people like what colors you painted the wall, whether the parking's, you know, it's a one-stop shop. Press Ganey is not, though they do have those questions, it has not been validated in the way that these other tests are, and it really doesn't focus on that stuff. So in our organization, we're trying to sort of write papers and do something else with the data. And so the Maslach, the Copenhagen, the Mini Z and Copenhagen entirely free, those are standardized and those can be used credibly in research. The other ones I would be a little more cautious about. But okay. In order to measure it, you have to measure it.
So one of the questions that comes up as well is burnout versus moral injury. I've heard people refer to them as though they're synonyms. I've heard other people talk about moral injury as a subset of burnout. What are your thoughts on those two terms?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, these things have sort of definitions. And so the burnout definition I've given, the moral injury is absolutely involved in burnout. It's kind of necessary, but not sufficient. A moral injury would be when you are in your job, do perform a service or witness a service or see something happen that conflicts with your values. And so the The one that's very evident in our organization or an organization like ours, maybe not our organization, in case one of us is listening, but when you work in a big network, you are given, you have partners basically in every specialty. So I have orthopedic partners, I have radiology partners, I have all these partners to whom I am expected but not required to refer to. And they may not be the best person for this patient that's sitting in front of me. And so it's a moral injury if I, A, send them outside of the organization because it was the expectation that I wouldn't. And it is a moral injury if I send them within the organization because I'm not providing them with the best care. And the biggest thing that's come up now is this idea of social determinants of health. That is a thing that causes moral injury because many people see it as, oh man, it's another thing I have to pay attention to. What really is going on there is I know that I'm writing this expensive prescription and this guy's not going to be able to afford it. I know that I'm sending him to an x-ray that he's not going to be able to afford. I know that he doesn't have bus fare to get where he needs to go. So it's a moral injury to us because now we have all this information that in our hearts we know we should act on, but that it's very difficult to act on. And it causes some injury in that. It's sort of this conflict between who I am and what this job is asking me to do.
So as another example of moral injury, as I talk to a lot of physicians, just the idea of providing a comprehensive visit within 20 minutes seems like it causes moral injury for some physicians and some advanced practice providers.
That is the last part of that slide. The rate limiting step often is care, right? That's what goes. When the people knock on the door and say, hey, we need you to produce more, you can either hire more doctors, you can or jam more patients per hour, or you can cut the amount of time you spend per patient. And if you're a conscientious doctor and it takes you 25 minutes, that's a moral injury to say I have to truncate this visit for a reason that has nothing to do with why we're really here.
Okay. So it sounds like they do overlap. How often do you find this issue coming up when you're talking to your physicians at Cook about their burnout or about how the depersonalization? How often do you find that moral injury issues are playing a role in the way that they're feeling and reacting to work?
Yeah, the depersonalization wouldn't be as much because generally moral injury is you're empathetic toward the person you're treating, right? That I am not providing everything I can. So if you hated those people, you would have no moral injury. I am fine, I am fine shorting making your visit shorter because I really don't care about you at all and I just want to get on to 5 o'clock. But moral injury is a lot. It is not uncommon that somebody comes to us and says they are asking me to do too much. And if you and I are the exact same specialty, seeing the exact same patient, you may be able to cut to the quick in 5 minutes and it may take me 15 minutes. And we have to understand that. And so one of the most common things we do is we sort of explain their contract in a way that tells them that if you need to have agency over this appointment, you need to have 20-minute visits rather than 15-minute visits. You can still do that and make within the parameters of your contract. And so we try to lay that out to them so they can have agency. As I said, the administration, whether beneficently saying, I'm not going to manage your clinic, or malevolently saying, I'm going to get them to work themselves to death by not understanding what their contract says. There's two sort of ways to look at that. But generally, at least in our organization, we have been able to sort of satisfy those people who came and say, I don't have enough time. We've been able to extend their visit so that they do have enough time and still can fulfill their contract. We've never had to go back and say, look, you need to expect less of this person in terms of workload. Now, we may be in a blessed organization, but if your organization is grinding you under its heel like that, it's not going to, that's an untenable situation.
That's helpful. Thank you very much, Kirk, for that explanation. I want to go back a little bit to one of the questions in the comments, and that gets back to how your organization has chosen to manage it and whether that's sort of a minimum standard now is Don's question about what's required to manage burnout in an organization. And do you need a dedicated person? I think many organizations, depending on their size and their ability to marshal resources for this, have used different approaches. But do you find that there is one approach that guarantees better success with managing physician burnout in our current healthcare climate?
It is always helpful to have someone sort of in charge of things, because if everyone's in charge of things, no one is in charge of things. And if you look at corporate responses, so if you just let the administrators sort of take care of it, they have come to something that they call in the burnout literature, burnout 1.0. And so that's the pizza parties and the healthcare memberships and the coloring books and things like that. It sort of blames the victim, meaning that it is not that the job is hard. The problem is you just haven't done enough sit-ups, or you haven't eaten enough pizza. Or, you know, a lot of organizations will have these sort of decompression rooms, which is fine. You step out of the storm for a little while, but eventually you go back up on deck. And so they're not great. That is the way in corporate world that they deal with burnout. And it's not best for the way physicians deal with burnout. You need this bigger systemic approach, understanding that the job, this idea of the too short visits, this idea of patient satisfaction surveys, these things are what are getting at it. And so you need someone to sort of pay attention to that. For us, it's we have two physicians both working half-time purposefully so that we're still out on deck knowing what's going on and having some credibility. Most of the complaints we get are from somebody just in the operating room lounge telling me, hey, you know, what's really bothering me now. And you know, this is a big deal. So it's helpful to have someone out in the physician community sort of taking care of those things, whether or not you need, if you did designate a person, they have to have good connections with the physicians who they're dealing with, or otherwise they just become an administrator, you know, removed from all that. I suppose it could be done with everyone sort of taking charge of it, but it can get pretty specific, and you can have to bother people to change things. And it's better, you know, to, I think, to have someone like us, me like an ombudsman, who basically is a bug in people's ears until things get better, and sort of the Jiminy Cricket sitting on their shoulder telling them it's the right thing to do. And it's good that I've been here a while, so I have some credibility, and people are used to me nagging them. So it's worked out for us, and I'm unaware of any place that just threw out an edict, fix burnout tomorrow, without a strategy to do it where they've had good success.
You mentioned that you had kind of a dyad partner, another physician, I assume. What specialty are they? Are they a surgical subspecialty or a medical? Or
No. Purposely, we chose a primary care doctor. So I am hospital-based, which is where the majority, we have 500 physicians and nearly 500 nurse practitioners. So where most of our work is done in this tertiary centers. So I interact with those people. She is a locum tenens by design, so that she's leaping around all the other practices, doing locum works at all those practices and seeing what goes on. So part of our clinical work also informs, obviously, our burnout work.
And has she had a long history with the organization like you have?
Yeah, she's about 14 or 15 years.
Okay.
And then you need to be in a place where people sort of trust you and know, you mm-hmm. know that you're on their side.
Great. Do you have other team members? There's another question from Don about the psychological support services. So a lot of organizations now have employee assistance programs. Do you have a team like that in the background that you can refer people to who are having more serious struggles?
Yeah, it's important to put a line between burnout and depression. They can, you know, sort of run together. But the way to know the difference is if you are depressed at work and you go to Disneyland, you're depressed. If you're burned out at work and you go to Disneyland, you ain't burned out at Disneyland, right? So burnout lives at the hospital mostly. We do have a physician assistance program that is not, it isn't under us. It's a different program away from us. The referrals actually come our way more, that the people were sent there because they were disruptive, because of X, Y, or Z happening. It really has a lot more to do with burnout than sort of their physician activities. But that stuff is available. We pay for, if we deem it necessary, we pay for 6 sessions with a psychologist at least. So that they can, or a psychiatrist, to go and sort of work those issues out. We also have a physician who is an executive coach, and we'll pay for 6 sessions with them. So if we see it's not a psychological problem. It is more a management problem. It is more sort of how I deal with people who are supposedly working for me. We often will also refer to physician executive coaches, basically, to sort of get that under place. So we do have other avenues to sort of move those people into if we identify that type of problem.
Okay. Thank you. So for a physician leader in an organization right now who doesn't have kind of an organized strategy or organized tactics to deal with the burnout crisis that we're facing today, what would be the first steps that you would recommend to them to begin addressing that problem and maybe some resources that they might have that they could refer to?
Yeah, I would go to the DMAIC thing, right? You got to test, you got to sort of figure out what it is. So the first thing would be to test. Maybe you're in a blessed organization where there's hardly any burnout and you could spend your resources should go other places. As you know, if you read anything, about 40% of us are suffering from burnout. So that is unlikely that you would be in a place like that. But that would be the first thing to sort of test, because if you're going to ask for resources, you're going to have data. You're going to have to say that this affects us and it affects us badly. If you just want to read about it, the books that the Bible, all this stuff I've talked about, those of you that know me personally, I'm not that smart. I got all this out of other places. And so the book that is best, it's called the Mayo Clinic Strategies to Reduce Burnout. It's by a guy named Schoenfeld and Svensson, I think. But Tate Schoenfeld now at Stanford sort of has run with the ball in burnout and has a lot of the innovative strategies and their step-by-step guide in there to sort of help you walk through it. And I literally have a tattered dog-eared, you know, copy of that to sort of go to when I need help. The AMA has an excellent sort of whole program. There's one program called the Joy in Medicine, which is a roadmap to sort of move your organization along. But they have a lot of resources otherwise. But it starts with testing. And then from there, you can see what your needs are and sort of how hard you have to push on it. And honestly, if your organization is in a bad position, the administration may be on your side to say, yeah, we need to do something about this. But that's the currency you have to bring, that we have a problem here and we need to fix this.
Was there, when you were addressing this in your organization, and I've heard some horror stories, I think we've all heard horror stories about physician suicide. You mentioned depression versus burnout. In your opinion, can burnout alone be the cause of physicians harming themselves, or is it always related to undiagnosed or misdiagnosed depression separate from the burnout, or maybe as a not separate from the burnout, but in addition to the burnout?
Yeah, smart. I thanks for remembering that. One of my partners, a urologist, died by suicide, I'll say 4 years ago. You know, no, there's no question that depression and burnout can run together. Having a terrible job is in no way going to lift you out of your depression. But the idea that there's been no sort of proof that burnout leads to suicide, but certainly they can those things can coexist. The issue with do people with burnout harm themselves? Not generally, intentionally, but you've seen people who work so hard that they never take any time off, that they never sort of take physical care of themselves. So yes, it does hurt you. And does it hurt you? You've seen people that work so hard that they miss their kids growing up, never go to a birthday party, don't see a baseball game. I see these and I am not the best dad in the world, but I see now and I understand when I'm watching my son's tennis match and some other mom or dad shows up and people are aghast that they finally came to one. This kid's been playing 5 years. You finally made one. And it's thought of as a joke in the moment, but it is a heart-wrenching thing now, because I talk to people who are like, I have never seen my daughter dance. I have never seen my kid play the piano. And so it hurts you in that regard in retrospect. If you look at studies that have been done of people that are recently retired, doctors who are recently retired or about to retire, and ask them what they would change, asking for more money is the bottom of the list. I would not want to earn more money. I'd want to spend more time with my family. I'd want to make sure I took the vacations. I'd want to. Now it's easy in retrospect to think about that, but we also should, sort of pay attention to our elders and understand what is really important at the end. And so it does harm you. Not to the point, thankfully, of taking your own life, but there's no question there's a consequence.
One of the other questions I have before I'll let you read Don's question there, but What about peer support programs for a lot of problems people face, whether it's substance use disorder or mental illness? Peer support can be a real foundational help to them. Have you found that same to be true in dealing with burnout?
Yes. So we have a multi-level sort of peer support. The one that everyone sort of enrolled in when they show up is the mentorship program. That has varying levels of participation. Some people really do want to have mentors. Some people are like, I don't need them. As I talked about, our organization is very aggressive in sort of acquiring practices. So it's not always friendly. They're not always super happy to come join us. So they don't need somebody to tell them what to do, right? And so those people have not hopped on the mentorship program very much. Plus, they're already experienced physicians. But mentors are certainly important. The other thing in a big organization like this is camaraderie, the idea that people are pulling for each other. So we do something. I'm a liberal arts graduate, so you may know what this word means or not, but commensality. We have a commensality program, which basically means people enjoying a meal together. So we randomly assign by location 6 people that meet. We pay for 6 meals over 6 months. They meet at night at a time in a place where they decide, and they have no restrictions other than they need to do, they sign up for the meetings and they'll do it. And so it's a way for us, and then we explode that group after 6 months. And if they want to join up again, we rearrange them. About 50% of the 500 doctors have participated, and it's got very good reviews, and it does make those bonds so that now you care more about the organization than you did before. We have a peer support program for people that have terrible events. So if you have a patient die or make a medical mistake or you're sued, this is a tricky thing to do because in Texas, anything you say to anybody that's not your lawyer is evidence, right? I think we talked about this just before we started here, that we don't want people hearing evidence. And so we have to specially train sort of people that have been through those events. We match them up with someone who just went through that event, not to necessarily sort of tell them what they did was okay or what, wasn't their fault or whatever, but just to sort of help them walk through the journey. By law, I mean, the lawyers will tell you, don't tell anybody anything. And these things take forever to adjudicate. And so the idea that for a year you sit there and stew in this mistake or this bad outcome without anybody sort of talking about it, it is terrible. And the people that go through it say it's terrible. So we've sort of trained people to do that. Thankfully, that's not a very often used program. But even now, we've expanded it to even, I put in a chest tube and gave the kid a pneumothorax. Someone the other day accidentally cut an artery, blood loss. It was all controlled. It all did okay. But they were devastated by the problem. And those people are offered that same sort of help. So there are personal things that we extend.
One last question I have, and then I'll let you answer the question on the screen. But so as you've measured the impact of your program, what does your organization look like now on the burnout inventory that you're using compared to when you started?
We're winning in burnout. So if you look at the 3 components put together, we're winning in burnout. We're losing in the last time we tested, which was 18 months ago. We're about to test again at the end of this year. We're losing in emotional exhaustion because we're super busy. The bounce here from the pandemic, during the pandemic, a lot of the other hospitals stopped doing pediatrics. And so all of a sudden, all these referral lines turned to us. So places that used to go to their local place, now they drive here. And so the bounce in terms of patient volume has gone up dramatically. And so we're losing in terms of people being able to separate themselves from the job. And so we're having to work on that. So the things when we did the test, we found the 4 biggest things that bothered people. We did a Pareto chart, another thing you learn in the MBA class, and we worked on those 4 hardest things. 3 of them we got better, 1 of them are still working on. But the good news is, like I said, we've shown return on our investment, and the administration thus far, until we mess it up, which I'm sure we will, has been pretty supportive.
Great. So I think you can see Don's question on the screen there, if you want to tackle that one. Yeah.
So the support services, I talked about the other one about doing med school. So if you look at burnout is not a generational thing. It's more what stage you are in life. College students are not burned out. Medical students are terribly burned out. And so what you need to do is sort of be medical schools that are being successful, they're being aware of those things. I mean, there's some stuff that medical students across the country talk about. They need to not be embarrassed or discouraged from asking, I need to go to a doctor's appointment. Can I go on next Tuesday? That is something that medical, no matter what medical school you're in, the medical students complain about. And residents as well. Residents, it's a bigger deal. TCU just opened the medical school, which they have put this wellness training in their, it's in their curriculum, so that they are constantly sort of seeing where the students are, and they are more project based, so that nothing's due necessarily tomorrow. It's all due 3 weeks from now, and the physicians are intimately, doctors who are practicing in the community are in the first 2 years of their education as well, so that you have sort of real world examples of sort of how to manage stuff and how things go. And so it's an innovative way to sort of teach medicine, but they believe that it would be a way that sort of strictly helps with physician wellness, so that they don't leave medical school already mad at everybody and already dreading what they're getting into.
Great. Well, thank you for taking all those questions. I know you talked a little bit about the impact of completing PEMBA on your career and on helping you with your burnout issues and those types of things. But I wonder if you wouldn't mind just sharing a couple more things about PEMBA. As I looked back on my PEMBA experience, which was way back in 2008, a little longer ago than yours, but I wonder what was your favorite memory of the PEMBA program? There were so many things that I enjoyed. I had a hard time answering this question for myself, but what was one of the favorite things that you remember about PEMBA?
I very much enjoyed being on campus. You know, other people would always dread, oh man, I'm going to be gone for 10 days, I'm going to be lost. And, you know, but I very much enjoyed that aspect of it because it's just, for me, it was just more fun to sort of talk to people, to have all those people available. And it was a big boost to my learning. I don't know that we had my class was in any way unique, but it was I knew by name and did work with literally everybody in that class. So it was great camaraderie. It was enlightening to me. We as physicians, and I believe one of the teachers at PEMBA told me this, but we as physicians are we have this idea that we're the smartest people in the room. It was someone who did negotiation. They said that, you know, any doctor would walk into a room and they're going to buy a car, and they like, give me 10 minutes and I'll know as much as you do about buying cars. And it's not true. And if you look, when I talked about how we went on the stock exchange, that is classic of that. We just thought we could manage that stuff, and we couldn't. And if you look at real estate, any of you physicians have sold a hospital or a surgery center, which is what we did when we were stock exchange babies, those transactions are among the most regulated in all of law. And it's to protect us, because we had a physician the other day, when we were selling the surgery center, that was mad about the price because we had just bought new anesthesia machines, and the buyers had to pay us for those new anesthesia machines, where the businessmen knew we're going to write those off anyway. What we're buying is the future business, but we could not get those people to sort of understand they don't want the carpet. Take the carpet with you. What they want is the business going forward. Mm-hmm. And so I learned that it wasn't a surprise to me that I wasn't as smart as I should be, but I learned that there are people as smart as us in all aspects of life, and to lean on them is good. And like, again, as I said, the opportunity for MD MBAs is right here, right? We know the doctor stuff that the administrators don't know. We know the administrator stuff that the doctors don't necessarily know. And provided we hit the ball down the middle, we can do pretty well.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for taking time out of your schedule today to meet with us. I think this has been a great live stream, and I look forward to having further conversations with you again. Maybe we'll have you back on the show in the future to kind of get an update on how things are going and monitor the progress there. But this has been a great show. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you. My pleasure.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.